Jyotish, Vedic astrology, the subtle mechanics that make up our existence in this universe. Greetings, Earthling. Yes, what up? Hey, yes, I'm talking to you. We're going to get a bit cosmic this episode. Welcome to the Vital Veda Show. I'm your host, Dylan Smith. I'm an Ayurvedic practitioner and holistic health educator based in Sydney, Australia. And we're just going to get straight into it because it's a lot to speak about, and I'm with one of the very highly experienced Vedic astrologer. Vedic astrology is called Jyotish, and it's part of the Vedas. The Vedas is that body of knowledge which governs the laws of nature, from which Ayurveda comes from, the science of medicine, the science of life, from which yoga comes from, meditation comes from it. Jyotish, Vedic astrology, Stapacha Veda, which is Vedic architecture, also known as Vastu, you know, architecture according to the laws of nature. There's Gandharva Veda, which is the sounds of life, the music of life that structures consciousness and sound therapy. There's so much to the Veda. There's even Dhanurveda, which is the art, the science of warfare, and tells all about that. So the Veda is this body of knowledge which governs the laws of nature, and is kind of then becomes bifurcated and fragments into, you know, from this one whole universal pure absolute field of consciousness. It then bifurcates and expresses itself in various forms, and we can kind of segment them into these forms, as I've explained. And Jyotish Vedic astrology is one of them, and it's a very profound tool, very hugely holistic. You know, we ain't just talking about holistic bodies, holistic medicine. We're talking about cosmic bodies. You know, we're integrating and including the cosmos, the cosmic weather, the rest of the galaxies, universe, stars. Particularly, you know, it's not going through all the galaxies, but it's maintaining, you know, nine planets, constellations. A certain proximity of astrological influences considered within Jyotish, and we're going to talk about that in this episode with one of the most experienced Jyotishes. His name's Blaine Watson, and he's studied astrology since he's a child, and we talk about that trip, and then eventually, you know, fascinating him and many people at that time around the 70s, I believe it was the 70s, you know, he went with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who was a Maharishi. Maha means great, Rishi means seer. And Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, famous for teaching the Beatles to meditate and spreading meditation and yoga and Ayurveda and Jyotish across the world and re-enlivening that Veda in a profound way. Blaine studied with him, and he became a teacher of transcendental meditation when he was 17, I believe, or around then. So he talks about it in the show, and it's pretty amazing. At that time, a lot of these, as you know, same with my teacher Tom Knowles, like a lot of them got onto this when they were 18. You know, here we're seeing an increase consciousness. You know, people are getting into the meditation at a younger age, and also getting heightened experiences and heightened states of consciousness at a younger age compared to, and in a quicker amount of time, they're developing these heightened states of consciousness. Forget about the age, that doesn't matter. All ages are developing higher states of consciousness and achieving higher states of consciousness and experiencing profound spiritual experiences in a much quicker time than decades ago. This is what many people such as Blaine and, you know, other people, teachers that I've met that have been doing this for decades, they've been teaching for decades, and they report now their students go into this stage much quicker. This is a example of right now how we are, you know, more evolved and evolved, and everything is evolution. And right now, you know, we're seeing more evolved societies, more evolved individuals. So this is a beautiful thing. We talk about this as well, and talk about it in regards to the increased interest in Jyotish and astrology in general. So we talk about that. So yes, Blaine, he started early, and he's, you know, several years of self-study in India, USA, you know, Spain, Netherlands, and Switzerland. He was, you know, considered an expert in Jyotish by the Dean of Department of Sanskrit in Varanasi. He's been a professional astrologer for over 30 years. He has more than 30,000 clients in over 30 countries. And people find Blaine by word of mouth only, because according to his tradition, he does not advertise. He does not advertise himself. And there's a few wonderful things about his tradition, how he operates, and we go into that a bit. And, you know, he consults all around the world, and he's also heavily trained in Ayurveda and Vastu, that Vedic architecture. And He learned to meditate in high school and has been a teacher of transcendental meditation for 45 years and has taught over 4,000 people on four continents how to meditate. Great guy. Heavily in demand right now as a Jyotish consultant, especially in my community. And he reveals how you can get in touch with him, because you won't find him anywhere on the internet if you wanted to have a consultation. So in this episode, we discuss what it takes for Blaine as an Vedic astrologer to do a reading. What subtle mechanics, what does he have to tap into? And what is the value of knowing Jyotish, your personal Jyotish, your astrology? We talk about Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. We talk about the Vedas as a universal, you know, people. We talk about the related Vedic people to the Sami people in indigenous Finland area, and also indigenous culture of Peru and Aboriginals. We talk about actions for those wanting to study Jyotish, differences between Vedic astrology and Western astrology, rectifying your birth chart if you don't know your time. This is what a valuable tool. What determines the time of birth? Because they get it down to the second in Jyotish. So what actually, when do you consider when that second of birth is? And very fascinating, the current Jyotish situation in this COVID-19 pandemic. What is the cosmic weather going on right now, and what is it looking like in the future? The benefits of knowing your Jyotish chart, solutions and remedies to support one's charts. We go into a lot of yajna, Vedic technology to commune with the laws of nature. Blaine's personal meditation practice, how gemstones work for astrology, Brahmins, the caste system, and much more. This is a dynamic interview. It's juicy. Get ready. If you enjoy what we do here at Vital Veda, you know, please support it. Share this. Share this with someone you think would be interested. Share it on Instagram story. Post about it. And if you're listening to this on time, well, you may be able to just join my online course, which is upcoming. We've got courses coming up on Ayurvedic anatomy and physiology, which actually the one I'm offering integrates Jyotish with my special guest, Dr. Harsha Raju, who is a medical astrologer. We're going to show how Jyotish relates with the physiology and connecting our individual physical body to our cosmic body and showing the correlations between the two. So, you know, if you are too late to join the live intake for that on August 22 and you listen to this after, we're going to release these to listen to the recordings, and you can have courses on Ayurvedic nutrition, courses on the essence of Ayurveda. A lot of greatness is coming up. So for all that information, you need to subscribe to the Vital Veda newsletter. Head over to vitalveda.com.au and you'll see on the top you can sign up. And of course, the Instagram is where you get the most regular knowledge if you enjoy this stuff. And check out the other episodes. We did do another episode on Jyotish. The second podcast interview I did, which is episode number 3, Jyotish Vedic Astrology with Anand Mehrotra, another renowned Vedic astrologer, a very cosmic man indeed. You can listen to that, and that was the foundations of Jyotish, and we explored the 9 planets, and this is kind of a bit of an extension from that. But it doesn't matter, you don't have to listen to one after the other, but check that out if you like this knowledge. And remember, for all our shows we have show notes detailed of what we talk about, and sometimes expanding on what we talk about. So check that out under the learn section under podcasts of vitalveda.com.au. Sit back, fasten your seatbelts, and let's dive in with the rocket ship into Jyotisha. Blaine, thank you for joining me. One of the most hottest Jyotishis out there now in terms of my circles that I'm in and people, you know, talking about Jyotishis. You've been doing this for how long?
That's a hard one to answer. I started studying astrology when I was 8, 9, 10. I can't remember exactly. That was Western astrology. And I studied it all through school, public and high school, elementary and high school. When I finished high school, I became a meditation teacher. I went to Europe and India and studied with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and ended up living and working and traveling with him for the next couple of decades. A few years after I became a meditation teacher, he introduced us to Jyotish. This is about 5 years after I became a meditation teacher. And I started switching over to Jyotish, which is the Indian version of astrology. But we call it the original version. And a couple of years after that, he asked me to make myself expert in Jyotish, which involved a much more intense version of study. That was in the early 80s. I've been doing it professionally since 1988. That's when I first started doing it as an actual profession, and have been doing it that way off and on ever since. So I've been actually doing nothing but Jyotish full-time for the last 20 years.
Yeah, and how many charts do you read a day? Because, you know, when people book into you, there's quite a waiting list.
Yeah, it depends. The waiting list is anywhere from 2 to 4 months, as you noticed. It depends on the time of year. Towards the end of the year, people start booking in for their annual readings at the beginning of the year. They want to know what's coming in the next year. So the last couple of months of the year and the first 3 or 4 months of the new year are the busiest. I do about 3 or 4 readings a day. It depends on the pressure, you know, how much demand there is. Each reading takes an hour to an hour and a half, as you've noticed. And then I have an open door policy with regards to questions. So I have about 50,000 clients in 40 countries around the world. So I'm handling hundreds of emails every day, just asking questions. And that's just a policy I have, because what price do you put on a question? And I don't know how to price that. So I just have this open door policy. So I spend about 3 or 4 hours a day just answering questions, in addition to the 4 to 6 hours a day I do with readings.
And what does it take for you to do a reading? Because I remember once we had a reading scheduled and you said, actually, can we do it tomorrow or another day? Because I'm not in the right state. I'm not tapped into that subtle realm.
Yeah, I meditate about 4 to 6 hours a day. And that I do whether I'm doing Jyotish or not. And that's about half of what I used to do when I was with Maharshi. I have to be clear and settled. I have to be in a kind of eager state of mind, if that makes sense to you. I don't want to be reluctant. I don't want to be tired. I don't want to be resistant to the reading. And so to be open, receptive, settled, and quiet is a necessary state. Sometimes there are factors in the cosmos that affect me just as much as they affect the world. And I end up feeling a little bit unclear or a little bit not eager, and then I would tend to put the reading off. That doesn't happen very often, but I tend to avoid doing readings on eclipse days. I tend to avoid doing readings on, I try to avoid new moon days if I can. If the pressure for readings is not too high, if I can afford to skip a day, I'll skip a new moon day like that. Fasting days, sometimes there'll be fasting days, and I'll skip readings on fasting days as well. But the idea is to be as clear and as open as possible, because the experience is that what you see, you become. So when I look at a chart, I become the person that I'm looking at. And I think one of the reasons that the readings are so exciting is due to their accuracy and the depth of detail that comes out. And the accuracy and the depth of detail that comes out is due to the fact that I'm paying attention to what my mind is telling me and what my body is experiencing while the reading is going on. I'm not looking just at the chart, but becoming the chart means I have to pay attention to the thoughts I'm thinking and the reactions my body is having at the time as well. So that becomes a part of the clarity. You as a person who takes pulse would be very familiar with that experience, that you take the pulse and then you feel that pulse. I mean, the pulse, I know with pulses that I've taken, I've also been studying Ayurveda for 40 years and multiple courses on pulse diagnosis. And I know that when I take a pulse, when I see that person again, even if it's 15 years later, I can still remember the pulse. I can still feel that pulse. I know exactly what that person felt like on my fingertips. So it's like that with the chart as well. And so being clear and settled is a necessary part of that experience also.
That's really beautiful. I definitely experienced that that individual pulse, and that's a beautiful way to explain it. I didn't think about it. I didn't really think much about it. I'm just.
I would be nervous if you didn't feel that.
No. It's totally right. Like, patient will come and you just. It's like an add-on to their previous pulse, even if it was years ago.
Right.
After so many pulses, it's beautiful. Yeah. Because you've connected with them, that's exactly. Why. So
I've actually literally fallen asleep during readings. If the person came to me in a state of fatigue, I have fallen asleep and gone into a dream state in the middle of a reading and woken up and asked the person I was talking to, "Are you by any chance experiencing a lot of fatigue right now?" And that person said they hadn't slept all night. And I said, "Okay, fine. We'll stop the reading now and we'll reschedule for a time when you're feeling more alert, because I can't stay awake while you're struggling to stay awake, you know."
So, yeah, wonderful. Yeah. And, you know, in Ayurveda, you know, in my practice, we have our various techniques in order to kind of, I guess, protect ourselves from our patients, you know, diseases or karma that might affect us. And we have the methods of washing with salt water and doing certain yajñas to protect. So how do you ever feel perhaps someone's hardships influence on you when you're doing that chart?
I feel their hardships, but there's no need for protection whatsoever. It's a question of discrimination. This is Advaita, the idea of proper intellect dictates that you know what is real and what is not real. That means that you know what is you and what is not you. So even though I become the person that I'm talking to, I become the chart that I'm looking at, I'm still very cognizant of what is me and what is not me. And so even though I fall asleep, if someone's tired, it doesn't affect me except that I fall asleep. But the psychology, the consciousness is not affected. I'm clear enough to know that I'm sleeping. I'm clear enough to know that it's not my fatigue, it's someone else's fatigue. So if I see someone coming to a reading and they're going through a very hard time, and a lot of people are, because otherwise why would you come to a reading? You know, the idea of getting a reading is to see what's there and what to avoid and what to go for. The Sanskrit phrase from the Patanjali Yoga Sutras is "Heyam Dukkham Anagatam," avoid the danger that has not yet come. So the main reason for having a reading is to do that. So if someone is coming to me in a state, a distressed state, I recognize the distressed state. I may feel the distressed state, but I'm not affected by the distressed state because I know it's not mine. It's theirs. And so intellectually, I can discriminate. This is real. This is not real. What is real is what is mine. What is not real is what is theirs. And in that separation, there's a unity experience. I'm feeling it. There's that underlying bond that gets put in place by simply connecting with another person. But within that unity, within that bond state, there's still this separation, and I can clearly distinguish what is not mine, and what is not mine doesn't affect me. So there's no need for protection. I don't have to go through any elaborate ritual to cleanse myself. There's nothing to cleanse. It's all just energy, and how I process that energy, how I experience that energy is what is, if you want to use the word protection, that's my protection. The fact that I'm aware of what is mine and what is not mine.
Mm. And another thing which I guess provides that distinction for me as a physician and you, same assume as that's related to this, is maintaining sattva.
Yeah, exactly.
That purity.
And especially for you as someone who actually touches someone, then that intellectual discrimination is even more necessary. I have distance on it because it's all done remotely. It's done by phone or it's done by internet, and I'm not in physical contact with that person. If I were in physical contact with that person, my discriminating intellect would have to be exercised even more so, because the body comes into contact with another body and it becomes more real, quote unquote real, because of that. So, but I think for you as a pulse diagnostician, you'll probably come, this is just my guess, that if your experience is like mine or anyone else's over time, you would probably come to the point where that need for protection is gone. Like Dr. Triguna, Brihaspatidev Triguna in Delhi, he would see upwards of, 1,200 to 2,000 people a day and take pulse all day long and just sit there and take pulse after pulse after pulse without having it affect him at all. He'd just be impervious to it. He was like a mountain that way.
Yeah. And I just would like to hear you talk more about your time with Maharishi. What I find really profound is that he, although he was not from any specific lineage of Jyotishis or even Vaidyas, Ayurvedic physicians, although he's still very much respected and asked the Vaidyas and the Jyotishis to share their knowledge, those who have been in it for many generations, he was still such an authority in these sciences and could give you people like you and other people such definitive way of going about it and learning it and practicing it.
So what's the question?
That's one thing about Maharishi I just find fascinating, how it's not like he studied Jyotishi a lot, to my knowledge, maybe, but although of course he's tapping into that foundation.
Yeah, we don't know what he did and didn't study. We know that he was with his guru Swami Brahmananda Saraswati for 13 years. We know that it took him about 2 years to gain enlightenment, because he says, he told us that it took him about 2 years to come into alignment with Gurudev's thinking. And that for us has to mean that he gained enlightenment. We know that his enlightenment happened very quickly. What knowledge he was exposed to in the ashram, he has never revealed to us. Not to me in any situation that I was with him in, but it must have been quite significant and very profound and traditional. His grasp of Sanskrit was absolute. Even when he spoke Hindi, it was an extremely refined and very high form of Hindi. But his enlightenment included the siddhis. That's very obvious. He exercised those all the time. We were exposed to it constantly on very, very subtle levels. And the siddhis included knowledge of everything. And so Maharshi's role in the world was to purify the knowledge, to eliminate incorrect knowledge and reestablish correct knowledge. And so a part of his being exposed to the Vaidyas, the Ayurvedic physicians, the Jyotishis, the Sanskrit scholars, the architects, the Sthapatyavedis, and the Vastu architects, the temple architects from India, he would take those texts and the knowledge that those people represented, and he would correct it. He would say, this is an incorrect translation. This is the correct translation. And he would do that with book after book after book. And it you'll find this as you evolve, that you will come into contact with knowledge. And because you're living the life you're living and doing the work that you're doing, your consciousness itself will tell you whether it's correct or not correct. You're probably already having this experience, walking into a grocery store and looking at food and thinking, this is food, this is not food. Your intellect is discriminating that way. This is edible and good for me. This is not edible. This is not good for me. So your mind is already probably working that way. So you can get a feeling for what it must be like from that level of consciousness that Maharshi lived, how his mind could know everything. He always said everything but one at a time, he could know all things but one thing at a time, like that. So he would be presented with one piece of knowledge and his mind would focus on that and correct it if it needed correcting, or verify it if it didn't need correcting. At least that's from my observant position, my position as an observer, that's how I experienced and interpreted it. Everybody comes to Maharshi from, their own perspective, and everybody has a different take on what they experienced with him. But it appears to be that that's the way it was. The pundits who were with him told us that that nowhere in the Vedas was there any record of anyone having achieved a state of consciousness that Maharshi achieved.
Hmm. And to get that kind of absolute knowledge, rather than studying the fragmented sources of knowledge or studying all the Ayurvedic text, you just go to the source, the foundation of knowledge, and then you can cognize all these things and recognize and distinguish between what is, you know, pure knowledge and what needs to be purified.
Possibly, yes. It could be from that perspective as well. I have a feeling Maharshi was functioning more in the gap, the gap between that absolute state that you just referred to and the relative state. Then the gap is where the siddhis take place. So it's the junction point between silence and action where all of this becomes accessible. So we many times we were with him and somebody would be speaking in a different language, say Italian or Spanish or whatever, and Maharshi would be speaking in English, and then a translator would be translating it into Italian, for example. I was with him once when this happened and experienced it directly, where the translator was translating it into Italian and they chose a specific word in Italian to indicate what Maharshi was saying. And Maharshi stopped him and said, no, that's not the right word. And he gave him the right word in Italian. So there was one time we were with him and somebody from Finland had brought a cassette recording of the Laplanders, in the indigenous people from Finland who take care of the reindeer. They're called the Sami people, S-A-M-I, Sami people. And they played their chanting. They have an oral tradition of knowledge there in Finland as well, and it's called Yoiking. And they played this. And it sounded, to a novice ear, it sounded like dogs barking, you know, really rough, really fast, really almost crude in a sense. And Maharshi asked the person who brought it to slow down the recording. So they had it on a recorder where they could slow down the speed of the recording. And when they slowed it down, it came out to be a more elongated, ha, 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 like that. And then he had it slowed down a little bit more and it became, like that, and became Samaveda. So the Sami people of Finland were taking care of the oral tradition of Samaveda from India. And Maharshi said this was the last remnants of the Vedic culture in Northern Europe. So at that point, he indicated to us that the Vedic culture was global at one point and that it had been preserved in different, it's still being preserved in different pockets. There's a village in South America, I think it's in Peru, if I'm not mistaken, where they write only in pure Vedic Sanskrit. When they write letters to each other, they write only in pure Vedic Sanskrit. So there are these little pockets here. How he knows this, I don't know. That's the thing. how he knew that yoiking chanting, that rough, crude chanting, how he could hear Samaveda in that, I don't know. But that's what he heard, and that's what came out of the recording when they slowed it down sufficiently. A real mystery that way.
Yeah, operating in those subtle realms, yeah, that Upasana Khand, for sure. Yeah. And I just want to share a similar story. I believe Maharishi asked my teacher, Tom Knowles, to go to the remote Aboriginal communities in Australian outback and play them Samaveda. And he did. And the elders of the tribes said to Tom, they said, this is my people. And if you've heard Aboriginal kind of chanting, it's quite similar.
Is it? Cool.
Yeah.
I know when Maharshi was shown photographs of Australian Aboriginals, he said they're all yogis.
Yeah, I once was documenting, I was traveling around India and just taking photos of them because I used to call them Vedic Aboriginals because they look, you could not tell. You show that picture of these Indians to Aboriginals and they would think it's their own people for
exactly.
Sure. If they didn't have the bindus and all the tilaks.
Yeah.
Okay. And you brought up one part of your own journey, which I think is relevant to quite a few people, because as Jyotish is increasing in popularity in the West, you know, it is in my circles and especially among the, you know, the younger people who are getting into astrology and they're finding out about Jyotish, and like, oh, this is a real more comprehensive, perhaps, aspects, a deep aspect of astrology that I want to explore and that I explore. And I see a lot of people who are into Western astrology and studying Western astrology and want to move or have an interest in Jyotish. So you mentioned you made that switch. What would you advise to people who are either Western astrologers themselves and want to start going in, diving into Jyotish, or just people who have a general interest in astrology and want to explore it more?
There are a million books that can be read. And that's an exaggeration, but I've got almost all of them on my shelves here in my office. I haven't counted, but it's several hundred. There are books that are written for beginners, and there are books that are written for people who are more experienced. There are Jyotish textbooks that are written strictly for people who are masters of Jyotish. They're basically incomprehensible unless you already have a very thorough background in Jyotish. If you are a Western astrologer, the switch isn't that difficult. There are some fundamental differences which are logical and clear once you understand the structure, the structural differences. We work with different zodiacs. So the Jyotish zodiac, as Anand probably explained, is called the sidereal zodiac or fixed zodiac. Sidereal means star. So it's a star-based system. And the Western system is a tropical or movable zodiac. And the tropical or movable zodiac that Western astrology uses is an artificial paradigm. It was an intellectual decision that was made, my understanding is, by the Vatican in the 1500s. They decided that because the Earth was moving, it made it look like the stars were moving, so that charts were calculated as though the charts are moving, as though the stars are moving. We know they're not moving; they're fixed in the sky, but the calculations are made as though they are moving, and that's a fundamental error in cosmology. And so the astrologers from that point onwards doing Western astrology began to make mistakes with their interpretations. So Indian astrology stuck with the basic astrology, the sidereal system. The signs of the zodiac are based on an amalgamation of what are called nakshatras in Sanskrit. These are the constellations that make up the signs. And there are two and a half, two and a quarter constellations that make up each sign. So Vyasa, the Rishi Vyasa, I think he's the one who decided that it was too difficult to understand or to memorize all 27 constellations. There are 27 constellations that make up the signs, and he said it was too difficult to memorize all of the qualities of all 27. He wanted to make it accessible to the general public in an easier way, so he divided them up and coordinated, amalgamated the qualities of the nakshatras into one sign. So 27 nakshatras became 12 signs of the zodiac. So one sign of the zodiac is usually a combination of the qualities of two, two and a quarter, two and a half of these constellations. If you see a horoscope, say you look at Johannes Kepler's horoscope from Denmark, I think he was the astronomer to the king of Denmark in the 1500s. I'm just going online to see when he lived. 17th century scientific German astrologer. No, it's not Johannes Kepler. It's someone else I'm thinking of. The Danish astronomer to the king of Denmark in the 1500s. His chart is available, and it is exactly Tycho Brahe, that's the one I'm thinking of. He was a Danish nobleman and an astronomer, and he was born in 1546, and he died in 1601. And if you look at his horoscope, how it was calculated, it is identical to a Jyotish horoscope. There's nothing Western about it. So they were still using the Indian horoscope in the late 1500s, early 1600s. And about that time is when the Vatican stepped in and made the change.
So is there any validity, and can you gain any information from the current Western system?
I can't comment on that. I'm not a Western astrologer, so I don't know. I really don't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I know that it's become more of a psychological kind of way of explaining a person's personality, as opposed to a system for making accurate prediction. Jyotish is used very practically in India. If you're with an Indian pundit, he will not spend any time talking about your personality. it's the last thing in the world he's interested in, and it's the last thing in the world that an Indian is interested in. They're not interested in the psychology at all. They want to know whether their son is going to get into the university he applies to. They want to know if they're going to get the promotion that they're applying for at work. They want to know if their daughter is going to get a suitable husband. They want to know, you know, all the practical things. And that's the thing with Jyotish. It's eminently practical. It's used to guide the daily life, to steer it in a way that maximizes success and minimizes failure.
Beautiful. So lucky to have that tool.
Yeah. It's a knowledge that's very genuine, and the predictive techniques are extremely precise. That's one very salient difference between Western and Indian astrology, that in Western astrology, they make predictions based on the transits exclusively. And that's a bit of a shotgun blast, because like the Saturn transit is 2.5 years long. So from Saturn, you can make a prediction within a 2.5 year range. With Jupiter, it's 1 year. With the Sun, it's 1 month. With the Moon, it's a day and a half. Mars, Venus, Mercury, 3 weeks, 6 weeks, like that. So very, very limited, very general ways of making predictions. But in India, we have multiple systems of prediction that can make predictions down to the fraction of a second.
Hmm.
We know the movements of the planets to nanoseconds. We know exactly where Jupiter is going to be 1 second from now, 2 seconds from now. We know exactly where Jupiter has been for the last 10 millennia. So that knowledge is there. We can make predictions based on these movements very, very precisely. And again, based on the exact moment of time that you were born. So we do require a very precise birth time in order to be able to do that.
Yeah, so you need the birth time and the birthplace. Most people have the birthplace, and if they don't have their exact birth time to the minute, you're one of the few Jyotishis that I know that can rectify charts and gather their birth time. So can you explain that process? Because it's quite an important service that you offer, and a valuable service that you offer.
It's not an absolutely essential service, because we do have techniques for giving someone astrological knowledge without a birth time. There are many, many people in the world who have no idea what their birth time is. If a person comes to me without a birth time and have absolutely no idea what their birth time is, then I can't find it for them. I have to have a starting point. But even then, if they don't know their birth time, we can do a horoscope for the moment that they call, for example. I can do a horoscope for the first moment they contact me. That's a legitimate way of erecting a horoscope for them. It's like they're born at that moment for me, like that. And we can make predictions that way. It's not 100%. I don't like it that much, but it can be done. We have a system in astrology called Prashna. Prashna is the Sanskrit word for question. So someone can come to me and say, I have a question. They'll email me, and they'll say, I have a question. I'll make a note of the exact moment that the email arrived in my inbox. I'll erect a horoscope for that exact moment. And that will tell me what question they're going to ask and what the answer is. It's a lot of fun, and there's a whole science around it. Some of the most fun astrologers in India are real experts in this. You can walk into their garden. They'll be sitting outside in their garden, and as you walk in through their gate, they'll be scribbling on a piece of paper, and you sit down and they'll turn the paper over and they'll say, these are your questions and these are the answers. It's a lot of fun. So if someone comes to me and they have an approximate time of birth, and this is very common, where a birth time is recorded as 1:05 in the afternoon, and a person is very rarely born at 1:05. It's usually 1:04 or 1:06, you know, like that, but somebody has rounded it off. I've talked with the delivery room personnel all over the world. In four continents, I've talked with delivery room personnel to find out what the procedures are for the time of birth. And the story is fairly universal. When you're being born, everybody in the room is being focused on you being born. So they're making sure you're delivered safely. You're cleaned up and you're presented to your mom or to your mom and dad if both parents are present. And then the delivery room personnel get together and they say, well, we did this for a few minutes. We did that for this long. We did that for that long. And the baby was born around this time. It's always an approximation like that. If someone is in the room to watch the clock to see when you're born, that's ideal. But then what constitutes the exact moment of birth is the next question. Is it when the head appears? Is it when the whole body appears? Is it when the first breath is taken? These are three legitimate times of birth in the Vedas. I prefer the time of breath, the time the first breath is taken, when the prana enters the body. When the prana is first taken into the body, that's what I think of as being actually born. We can find the time of birth by following the trajectory of a person's life. So your horoscope at the time of birth gives you a trajectory. It gives you a certain direction in life, which provides you with the experiences that you have. You have accidents, you have illnesses, you have successes, you have failures, you have relationships, you have work, you have children. These are all fairly significant events in a person's life. And if we have the exact dates of those significant events, we can follow that trajectory back to the beginning point. And so for birth time rectification, we take 8 to 10 dates, the more the better. And we just track it right back to the time of birth, right to the second. We can find it right to the second. And the more dates we have and the more precise the dates are, the more accurate and reliable the time of birth is. It's a lot of fun. It's one of my most favorite things to do because it's like sometimes finding a needle in a haystack. It's kind of neat that way. I did this for my dad. My dad was born at home on the farm in the kitchen, on the kitchen table. And he didn't know his birth time, except that he knew that it was around lunchtime, which in the modern era was always around noon, right? Like when we say we're having lunch, we have it at noon hour here in Canada. And so I was doing his birth time. We had a lot of good dates for him, a lot of big events in his life. And the time of birth came out always, every time I went to it, always came out to be around 9 a.m. in the morning. And so finally, I got very frustrated with it. And I went to him and I said, Dad, you said you were born around lunch, but the chart keeps saying 9 a.m. And around 9 a.m. He said, yeah, that's right, lunchtime. So he was born in the harvest season in the province of Canada where all the wheat and grain is grown. So all the men, including his father, were out in the field harvesting the wheat. At that time, it was done by hand and with threshing machines, but they had to be tied. The stooks had to be tied by hand. And they were all out in the fields from about 3 a.m. Before the heat of the day. And they came in for lunch at 9 a.m. And that's when he was born. So it's kind of a neat confirmation when you're given one piece of information and you have a particular idea in your mind as to what that means. And then the reality turns out to be the reality. You know, it didn't fit my paradigm. It actually fit the real paradigm, which was his lunchtime. So it's a fun process and it works quite well. And I do it all the time. I probably do 4 or 5 a week like that because many, many people just don't have exact birth times.
Definitely a good thing for everyone to have on hand, I think, to have their exact birth time for when you do come across a Jyotishi and you want to have a consultation.
And once you find it, you find it, you know, so.
Yeah. Okay. Lane, I would love you to speak about the current Jyotish situation, the current cosmic weather with what's going on. Today is in Australia is July 8th and where you are, it's July 7th. So we're, you know, in the midst of COVID-19 and having another, in Australia, we're having another kind of big thing happening with the state of Victoria. And we've just had recently all the riots with the Black Lives Matter movements and all this race, anti-racism movements and everything that's going on. So yeah, the world there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you could give a little picture of what's governing this.
That's not my forte. I don't usually look at the world. The world picture doesn't interest me so much because the world is always going on, right? So, but that said, I have been predicting the events of this year from at least a couple of years back. In 2018, I started predicting that 2020 was going to be shaping up to be something unusual, something we haven't seen before. People are emailing me today with an email I sent out last fall where I predicted everything that happened this year, minus the virus. I didn't predict the virus. I only predicted the changes that the virus would prompt. And my predictions included the idea of a break for the environment, that the environment would be improving. A reset of the economy, a reset in politics, and a movement towards greater social, financial, and political justice, we could say. We call it justice like that. These predictions were predicated on the fact that many planets this year are placed in their own signs in transit. So if you go out at night and you have a very clear view of the sky without distortion, you'd be able to see the planet Saturn in his own sign in the sign of Capricorn, Jupiter in his own sign in the sign of Sagittarius, Mercury today, now in his own sign in the sign of Gemini with Rahu. Rahu is in what's called his Mula Trikona sign. It's a version of his own sign, a section of his own sign that gives him greater power. Ketu is in his own sign, in the sign of Sagittarius as well, his Mula Trikona, what's called Mula Trikona. Venus is in his own sign right now as well. So out of the nine planets that we work with, six at the moment are placed in their own signs. The only three, the three that are not, are the Moon and Mars and the Sun. This is a rare event, and it gets better. In September 13th and 14th of this year, eight out of the nine planets will be placed in their own signs. This has never happened in our lifetime. It will not happen again in our lifetime. The last time it happened was approximately 500 years ago. The next time it happens could be, I haven't done the calculations on it, but could be another 500 to 1,000 years. When a planet is placed in his own sign, he's in a good mood. He's at home. He's comfortable, and he's particularly strong. Of these six planets that are placed in their own signs right now, three are retrograde. That is, they appear to be moving backwards in the sky at the moment. That's an optical illusion. It's due to relative motion. That's Saturn is retrograde, Jupiter retrograde, and Mercury retrograde. This happens once a year for every planet, or more often even for some. And like Mercury. And when a planet is retrograde, it makes the planet more powerful. So it produces even stronger results than it normally would. So an upsurge in the virus is not surprising with so many retrograde powerful planets in place. The trick is to interpret these events, the protests in America due to racial inequality and injustice, the upsurge of the virus in many places around the world, particularly in America, which has addressed the virus very ineptly, but as you're noticing in Australia, also in some places. In other places, like here in Canada, very minimal. We've flattened it, and it seems to be staying flat. That's mostly because we're Canadians. How do you get 100 Canadians out of a swimming pool is a popular joke here. The answer is, you ask, okay, everyone out. We just do what we're told. So we're told to go home, we go home like that. So in Canada, it's pretty quiet. But the idea is to interpret these global events from the perspective that nothing happens to us, everything happens for us, but only 100% of the time. And when you understand that perspective, that it's called the force of evolution for a reason. If it is the force of evolution, that is moving the whole universe, or the universe of universes, if you want to expand it to infinity, if you understand that that's an evolutionary force, it means that yesterday is always a lesser evolved state, right? We're always stepping forward, stepping forward, stepping forward. But evolution being a force means that sometimes we have to be forced to pay attention. We have to be forced to perhaps act in ways that we would normally not act in without the force. So everything that's happening with the virus, whether it's artificially created or naturally created, whether the reaction is positive or negative to that, we have to understand that. And it doesn't matter how many conspiracy theories there are. It doesn't matter. That's irrelevant. The reality is that the world is responding at this particular time in this particular way, going home, being quiet, resting and being settled for a particular reason. And so these changes are driven by the force of evolution. In the past, we would have a global war instead. Stress builds up in the world. Stress has to be eradicated. It has to be neutralized. And in the past, it got neutralized through war. We have these world wars as a result of a buildup of stress in collective consciousness. Or there would be a collective calamity of some kind, a major earthquake or a tsunami like we had several years ago, or a hurricane, some major event that would affect large numbers of people in a very destructive way. Now, in the last 50, 60, 70 years, or 100 years, or 124 years, if you want to be really precise, from the moment that Vivekananda came to America and addressed the Parliament of Religions in Chicago in 1896, from that moment onwards, the West has been exposed to Eastern thought, Advaita, the non-dual philosophies, and especially in the last six decades, thanks to Maharshi and Baba Muktananda and Krishnamurti and Amichi, the hugging saint, all these people teaching meditation, teaching yoga, raising consciousness worldwide. The consciousness of the world is more purified and more refined. And so when stress builds up in the world this year, rather than going to war, we were asked to go home and be quiet. You can see the intelligence in it, right? There's some genuine intelligence at work here. The force of evolution has become more refined. It has become more less harmful, more less destructive, more kind, more gentle, more compassionate. And that's on the basis of the rise in world consciousness that we're experiencing. How many millions and millions and millions of people around the world are saying, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people around the world now say that they practice yoga, say that they practice meditation. When I first started meditating almost five decades ago now, I was essentially alone. You know, you talk about meditation at that time and they would think you were some kind of freakish anomaly, some kind of alien from another planet. And that's how I felt. But these days you talk meditation and everybody says, oh yeah, I do that. Or, oh yeah, I'm interested in that. There's no resistance to the idea hardly at all, except from these, you know, fundamental religious quarters. But the idea is that we have evolved. And so this is reflected in the planetary situation that's currently going on. There's still some purification taking place. The upsurges are going on around the world. There's still some political hotspots and some tensions here and there. But for the most part, the world is reacting the way the world should react, and that is by pulling back and being quiet. You as a healer know that the best way for the body to heal itself is just to give it rest. You know, if there's some imbalance in the system due to stress or improper diet or some repeated action that has caused a wear and tear in the body, we put the body to rest, and the body, given that chance to rest, will heal itself. It's a very simple process. So here on a global scale, we're being asked to heal ourselves. And you can see the healing process taking place. You know, all the inequities of the world are bubbling to the surface as a result. It's such a joy to see, really a joy.
Absolutely. And you're saying September 13th, 14th, and other 2 to 3 planets, another 2 planets will also be placed in their own signs. So will that amplify the purification, or do you think things will settle or amplify the evolution?
Very hard to predict because we've never been there before. You know, it's just we've never seen it before. So we don't know with absolute certainty what is going to take place. Now, I'm just going to scooch ahead here to September in my program, and we'll take a look at what it looks like on September 13th. So September 13th, Ketu and Jupiter in Sagittarius in their own sign, Saturn in his own sign in Capricorn, Mars in his own sign in Aries, Rahu in his own sign, Mula Trikona in Gemini, the Moon in his own sign in Cancer, Venus is there in Cancer, no longer in his own sign. The Sun is in his own sign, and Mercury is in his own sign in his Mula Trikona. So that's 8 out of the 9 planets. Depending on the time of day, and depending on which country you're in, the results are going to be different. For some countries, it's going to be an absolute glorious awakening and a moment of great clarity on a national level. For some other countries, depending on the time of day that these planets move into these signs, it can hit them in another spot, and it depends on if that country requires purification or not. If the reaction from this particular planetary configuration will depend on what state those countries are in at the time of the configuration. So some countries will experience it more strongly than others. And there are ways of predicting that. And given the number of countries in the world, that's a huge amount of work to make predictions for. It's way beyond my lazy streak. I'm just too lazy to do that. So we'll make a broad shotgun prediction and say in some spots it'll be intense and in other spots it'll be pretty good. And it'll be fairly polarized, you know, it's because this configuration is a rare one. You can imagine the babies that are born on the 13th and 14th of September. It's going to be quite significant. This is the thing with your generation. You were mentioning earlier how people your age are interested in astrology these days. Maharshi predicted this decades ago. He said that the next generation of children would be former yogis and people who were on the path before, and they would be born with knowledge, and they would be born with a desire for that knowledge, and they would be the ones who would carry the planet forward. So yeah,
you can definitely see that
happening. So we have another generation being born here in the fall and all this year, because we have multiples of these configurations. Like right now there's 6 out of 9 planets. That's a significant horoscope. Anyone born today would have a very significant horoscope. 3 retrograde planets. The prediction is that if a person has 2 or more retrograde planets in their chart, it's the chart of someone who's born to accomplish something of lasting significance in their lifetime. So we have 3 retrogrades right now with 6 planets in their own signs. This year is going to produce a whole generation of world leaders, basically, is what it boils down to in every sector of life.
So beautiful.
Yeah, very annoying for those of us born way, way back.
Start producing, guys. How long do we have to produce children?
Yeah, really. Eh? I think it's a bit late for September.
Okay, September. It's got to be before. Okay. All those who are pregnant, lucky.
Yeah, but Saturn will be in his own sign until January of 2023. So that can, Saturn in his own sign, depending on what time of day a person is born, will produce the chief of a village. President Obama had Saturn in Capricorn in his own sign, in his rising sign. He was born at the time when Saturn was in his own sign, in the rising sign, and he became the chief of his village. Mm-hmm. So that prediction is a very genuine prediction.
And fascinating how people get these celebrities and famous people's birth times that are pretty easily accessible.
Yeah. There are websites dedicated to that.
Okay.
You just Google celebrity horoscopes.
Mm.
You'll come up with.
Not Google. We don't say Google. Type it in a search engine.
Type in the search engine. Yes.
We don't promote Google.
In celebrity horoscopes in your search engine and you'll come up with websites with tens of thousands of individuals and their times and dates and places of birth. And one of those legitimate websites will tell you whether the birth time is accurate or whether it's a guess like that. They'll say it specifically. Like for Joe Biden, for example, they'll say that it's not a 100% reliable birth time. It's a guesstimation. But based on the chart that we have, Joe Biden wins by a landslide this fall.
Okay.
Trump fades into ignominy.
Okay.
A smudge on global history.
Mm. So, Blaine, like earlier you were mentioning about the kind of the benefits of learning about your personal Jyotish. Can we elaborate more on that if people, you know, are interested to get a reading and how they can use Jyotish as a tool for their personal evolution and their personal role in the evolution of things?
Just that it's a tool. Every horoscope has... We have 2.1 million details that we have to memorize before we even can open a horoscope. It's a science of memory. It's all about smriti. It's how much you can retain in your mind. That's what allows you to look at a chart and interpret it. So out of 2.1 million details, where do those come from? We have 27 constellations, 27 nakshatras. We have the 12 signs that those nakshatras comprise that result in that. We have 9 planets. We have 16 major subdivisional horoscopes. There are probably more like 150 subdivisional horoscopes, but we use 16 major ones. Each of these areas of the chart, the 27 nakshatras, the 12 signs, the 9 planets, there are 12 houses in the chart. There are 16 subdivisional charts. Each one yields information. The information that it yields is basically without limit. The limitation is imposed by the memory of the astrologer. If the astrologer can remember more, he will provide more detail. If he remembers less, you'll get a general and very vague reading. Like that. So it all depends on how strong the memory of the astrologer happens to be and how clear his intuition is, because with these details that are memorized, once they're memorized, then the intuition begins to function. The intuition begins to integrate the different pieces of information and presents the mind with a coherent and cohesive picture. So people come for the readings for very many different reasons, but there are main reasons people come. They want to know about their work. They want to know about their health. They want to know about their relationships. They want to know about their money, like that. These are the big, big areas that people are mainly interested in. It's universal. It doesn't matter which country or culture a person comes from. It doesn't matter what their background is. They want to know about these areas. Everybody wants to know the future. Some people don't get readings because they're afraid of the future. But I'm very, very well known, I think. And I think people come to me because I'm well known for this attitude that nothing happens to us, everything happens for us, but only 100% of the time. So if we see a problem looming on the horizon, we can do something to avert that. So for example, every horoscope comes with problems. We get born with karma. If we don't have any karma, we're not born. It's very simple. So if you're in a human body, it means you have karma that you have to work out. So we have problems. If the chart presents problems, the chart also presents solutions. They're hand in glove. They go together. And if you go to an astrologer and he says, you have this problem, but he doesn't offer you the solution, it doesn't mean the solution is not there. It just means he doesn't know it. It goes back to memory, or it goes back to how much knowledge he has or doesn't have, he or she. So it means go to another astrologer, because the problem is going to be the same problem no matter what astrologer you go to. So you want to find an astrologer that can present you with solutions, not somebody who can say, oh, you have a problem, and leave it at that. That's what Western astrology does. Western astrology, in my experience, says you have this problem, and then they'll say, oh, that's too bad. There's nothing you can do about it. But in Vedic astrology, Indian astrology is all about the solutions. We have yagyas, we have gemstones, we have Ayurveda with Panchakarma. I've studied Ayurveda for 40 years. I do Ayurvedic consultations as a natural part of my Jyotish readings. This herb is for this, and this herb is for that, and do this and don't do that, and this daily routine, you know, Dinacharya, and all like that. So if I see someone's chart saying, you're going to have arthritis at the age of 55 because you're eating tomatoes every day today. At the age of 25, I'll tell them, stop eating the tomatoes. You know, the tomatoes are acidic. They are nightshades. They have the same chemical in them that tobacco has, nicotinoids. They are inflammatory, and you will end up with arthritis for sure at the age of 55 or 60. So stop now. So if we can see that in a chart, it gives us a clue as to what their diet is. We can see, like I did a chart today for a woman whose menstrual cycle stopped. And I found that out because I asked her. I said, is there some issue with your menstrual cycle? And she said, yeah, it stopped a couple of years ago. And I said, okay. And we went into the detail of it, and I gave her the solution. I told her what to do to restart the menstrual cycle. So the chart said that for the current period of time that she's in. We can say that for 20 years from now. We can see 20 years from now if a person's going to be having difficulties with health and what those health problems are, if they're going to have money trouble, what those money troubles are, if they're going to have relationship problems, what those relationship problems are. And seeing it that far in advance, seeing ahead like that, like I said earlier, heyam dukam anagatam, avert the danger before it has come. So the idea is, seeing it on the horizon, we can do something to prevent it from happening. Or if not prevent it entirely, the karma may not allow us to prevent it entirely. We may be able to minimize it, either through yagya or through adjustment in daily lifestyle or diet, or, you know, whatever is needed. So in this way, it becomes a very practical tool. It's extremely useful to have this information, to know what is positive and to support that, and to know what is negative and to avoid that, or to modify or minimize it. With enough money, you could minimize it, or it completely eliminate every problem in life. You just have to have enough yagyas done. as Maharshi says, you could hide in the transcendent. You could meditate 8 hours, 10 hours a day. Mm.
But that's not very relevant for your contribution to society.
And there are very few people who have that type of physiology that would support that. I meditated 8 hours a day for decades, but that's my physiology. I have the physiology that can support that.
I just want to mention, for those who don't know, yagya is a type of Vedic technology where typically performed by, or it should be performed by, Vedic pundits or priests who are offering precious substances and mantras, primordial sounds, into certain ritualistic way to trigger certain laws of nature, and they can do it specifically for you and your Jyotish chart.
For the chart, for the planets, there's a ceremony for every planet. The ceremony for a planet involves the recitation of 135,000 mantras for each planet that is affecting you. So it's the sound vibration that provokes the change that's needed. If you want to change the future, you have to go into the past and change the past. And the past is this the history of our lives is the history of the human race is stored in the DNA. So the purpose of these ceremonies, the sound vibration of the ceremony, the purpose of it is to restructure the DNA, to actually change it so that the past is eliminated or modified, and that automatically gives us a better and brighter future. So there are ceremonies for each planet that affects us negatively or positively. There are ceremonies for every area of life. There's a yajna for perfect health, a yajna for wealth. There's a yajna for having children if you can't have children. There's a yajna for finding a suitable marriage partner, winning court cases. There are yajnas for improving your memory, yajnas for harmony in family life. Every single area of life has a ceremony associated with it. And it's just a question of, you know, having the money to do it. The pundits don't want us to go into debt to have them done. So then there's a little karmic issue involved in that you have to be able to pay for it. But it's a very good shortcut to eliminating karma. You can burn off karma through meditation practices, through yogic practices, through Ayurveda. Panchakarma is a very good way of burning off karma. Yajnas are a very, very subtle and very powerful technology for restructuring the DNA and changing the karma as a result.
Just a personal question. You mentioned you do 4 to 6 hours, or I think you said 3 to 6 hours of meditation practice a day. Uh-huh. That's twice a day, right? So divided by two each session.
Yeah, each session is 2 to 3 hours at a time.
And what are you doing, if you'd like to share?
Less than nothing.
what's the technique? I assume you're doing sutras of Patanjali. What else, if you'd like to share? What's the intention?
Just closing the eyes and quietening the activity of the mind through mantra meditation, mm-hmm. and then the Siddhi Sutras of Maharshi Patanjali, all the way through to yogic flying, and then resting afterwards. That's about it. And how much time I spend on each segment of that process is dictated by how much time I have to dedicate to it. So there are various techniques that Maharshi gave me over the years. I have techniques that I also do at night while I'm sleeping, and techniques for if I fall ill, which doesn't happen at all, usually ever. But if I do, Maharshi has given us techniques for when we fall ill as well.
Mm-hmm. And other than yajnas and all the things we talk about, one of the upayas, is that right? Like remedies?
There are different upayas. Yeah, I don't favor upayas. Hart Defoe does in California. He likes them a lot, but that he acquired from his teacher in South India. But there are many different upayas. Yeah. Mm-hmm. For example, staring at your face in a pan of oil on a Saturday for taking care of Saturn, or my favorite is buying a green parakeet and setting it free on a Wednesday for Mercury. That's a little bit of an industry in some parts of India where the little boys run around capturing parakeets and then they sell them to people and then they set them free and then they go and recapture the parakeet over and over again. there are all kinds of upayas like that. They number in the thousands. And they're fun.
Is gemstones considered an upaya?
What's that?
Are gemstones considered an upaya?
No, that's a very different process. That's taking advantage of the earth's energy and the parts of the earth that are resonant with the different planets. So you wear a gemstone for a particular planet because the vibration of that gemstone is resonant with the vibration of the planet. That's a very different story. The upayas, they do have their subtleties. You know, there are different connection points for sure with these upayas, but they're temporary fixes. They're not permanent fixes. It's not like a yajna where the yajna fixes the issue permanently because it goes in and actually restructures the DNA. An upaya is kind of like a band-aid. It fixes it for that moment, but you have to keep doing it and doing it and doing it like that. So it's not a permanent solution to an issue at all. Or transcending is a very permanent way of resolving issues as well. You can just, like the Gita says, knowledge purifies, and pure knowledge is the greatest purifier of all. And when the Gita uses the term pure knowledge, they're referring to the knowledge of the self, the the transcendental field. So coming into contact with that transcendental field on a regular basis, that field of silence within us, has the effect of purifying the nervous system, which has the effect of purifying the mind. Our thinking process changes, and when the thinking process changes, our future changes. So there, if you're doing it all, you know, if you're doing yagyas, if you're doing Ayurveda, if you're doing, you know, Jyotish, if you're doing, Jyotish isn't a practice, but if you have knowledge of the future, if you're doing meditation and yoga, all these purificatory practices, you're basically really moving yourself along the evolutionary scale very rapidly.
Mm-hmm. You answer my question partly, which was going to be, what are the effects? How do gemstones work and how do they influence you?
Do you have anything to add to that? Yeah, we use the gemstones for the planets that do us the most good. There are two systems of gemstone prescription that are used in India. In North India, you'll get a prescription for the gemstones, get the prescription for the planets that cause you the most trouble. And they prescribe the gemstone for that planet and they put it on the appropriate finger, but they put a plate, a metal plate, between the gemstone and your skin, so that the logic being that the planet is attracted to that gemstone and not you. but it's a kind of a faulty logic, because I don't want that planet looking anywhere near me at all, let alone the stone on my finger. So in South India, and this is the prescription method that we favor, the one that Maharshi educated us in, they prescribe the gemstones for the planets that do us the most good, the ones that are considered, quote unquote, the lucky planets in our sky and in our charts. And so what we do is we prescribe the most fortunate gemstones, the gemstones for the most fortunate planets, and we set them so they touch the skin, so that the light of the planet, the light of the sun and the planet for that stone, shines through that stone and onto the skin. And actually we catch that vibration with our body. The bigger the stone, the better the results. And it's a slower process than yagyas because it's a stone. It's something very physical and very dense as a rule. And so the results are slower, but they are quite noticeable.
So in addition to having similar elements in the stone and in the planets, you'd also say there's a light therapy intervention there?
Yeah, we could say that. There's a light therapy element. We know that the DNA is sensitive to light. You can wrap, the DNA gets wrapped in light. And so you can basically modify the light that wraps around your DNA through a process like this one.
Okay. And my other question was in relation to yagyas, you know, there's many types of, well, I mean, of course, there's types of yagyas, but getting it with different pundits and different sources of getting the yagyas done. You're pretty stern about doing the 135,000. Why? What can you go into that and what that is?
Stern is an interesting word. I've been trained in how to do planetary yagyas. They're as boring as you can possibly imagine, because you're just
Trained to be able to conduct one? And
Well, to do one myself, I've been trained how to do that. But I don't, because to do 135,000 repetitions, it would take me, and I've done it, takes me 2 weeks, a minimum of 8 hours a day for 2 weeks. And it's incredibly boring. Because it's just the same mantra over and over and over again. And you're not even doing it for yourself. You're doing it for someone else. You really have to have a very strong dharma in order to be able to do that day in and day out. And the pundits in India who perform these ceremonies are born into these traditions. It's a very, very ancient genealogy. They know the names of their grandfathers going back 27, 28 generations. You know, they memorize these names. So it's very, very much a part of their DNA. And they come to it very naturally and very easily. So 135,000 repetitions does a nice job. You can do much less. You can do 30,000. The vast majority of pundits in India will do 35,000, 70,000, like that. 70,000 is rare. 35,000 is more common. 19,000, 20,000, like that is even more common than that. The pundits we use that I like, I've been working with for 30 years, they do 135,000 repetitions. And we have a mix of pundits, young and old. We like the old ones because everything is in memory. They don't have the textbooks in front of them when they're performing the yajnas. They have it in memory and it just flows. And there's a lot of power in that flow. We have the young ones there to give more dynamism to the process, more energy to the process, if you will. And the combination works out to be very, very wonderful. We get good results from that. We have about a mix of half and half, people who are pundits who are regular meditators and pundits in the TM tradition, and half that are not in the meditation tradition like that. And the half that are not, they still meditate. They have their own meditation practices. The Brahminical practices are meditative, but they're different than what I'm familiar with. So we mix it up like that. It's like they say in India, you want a young surgeon and an old vaidya. So you want the old vaidya for the decades of wisdom that he's acquired. You want a young surgeon for the steadiness and skill of his hands and his coordination.
Mm. Yeah, I once heard someone say to me, it really resonated with me. He said, there's two people in this world, two types of people that we value so much, and that's Vaidyas and pundits.
Yeah.
The pundits, I mean, they hold these their ability to perform these procedures and have that knowledge is so precious, and that's why we're in absolute reverence to them. And then traditionally they're really highly revered and give them all these gifts. Yeah, it's pretty,
especially when you meet one who is genuinely knowledgeable.
Yeah.
And it's like any profession, there are varying degrees of intellectual capacity. They have contests in India to see who has memorized the most of the Veda. And the contest is a very simple one. They have a group of pundits who sit down and they start chanting, and the last one left chanting wins. And they can go on for weeks. Memorizing the Veda is a little bit like memorizing the New York telephone book forwards and backwards. It's a major, major accomplishment to do that. And it's really remarkable to be in the presence of people who have that degree of intellectual capacity. You just want to sit with them and be with them all the time. And you meet a knowledgeable vaidya, an Ayurvedic physician, someone who's ideally coming from a family background of Ayurveda, not the college training like you see most often these days, but somebody whose knowledge has come to him through his grandfather and his great-grandfather and his great-great-grandfather like that. They have knowledge that's different than what is taught in the colleges, and it's very, very special. Mm. There's a family in India that knows how to cure leprosy, for example.
Yeah.
There's a family in India that was present when Jesus was born. Mm. The three magi. In India, they're called Magi Brahmins. They're Mishra Brahmins. They're very in their family line, they tell the story of three astrologers from their family who traveled to the West to see an incarnation of Vishnu. They tell this story, and they've told it from father to son for generations.
Yeah. And they met Jesus in the West?
They met Jesus in the West. Israel is west of India. So they traveled to the West. They followed the Eastern Star, is the way the story goes. But for them, it was to the West like that. So, and they were called Magi, but in India, they're Magi Brahmins. It's Magi, same spelling, M-A-G-I. India is full of mystery like this.
Is Magi the family name or the type
Magi
of Brahmin?
Magi is the type of Brahmin. They're called Magi Brahmins or they're called Mishra Brahmins. And you'll see the family name in India as Mishra. Gurudev, Maharshi's teacher, was a Mishra Brahmin. Mm-hmm. If a Mishra Brahmin shows up at a conference, say, for example, my Ayurvedic teacher was R.K. Mishra. If he showed up at an Ayurvedic conference and gave a speech, nobody else would speak. Mm. They wouldn't dare to speak because he was the repository of so much knowledge that nobody dared to stand in front of him to try to present knowledge. They just knew that anything they knew was less than what he knew.
Mm-hmm. And so you're saying there's generally two types of Brahmins, are you saying? Or there?
Oh, no. There are dozens, hundreds of different types of Brahmins. There are many, 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 many different Brahmins. Very many different castes. Maharshi was a Kayast, K-A-Y-A-S-T. It's a Brahmin sub-sub-sub-sub-caste that's such a sub-caste that they're allowed to make money any way they want. A Brahmin can make money by giving knowledge. That's the way the tradition works. And so they're limited in terms of how they can make money. Maharshi's Brahmin sub-sub-caste doesn't have that restriction. They were allowed to make money any way they wanted. But Maharshi took a traditional role. When the Shankaracharya, when Swami Brahmananda Saraswati passed away, the story goes that Maharshi was asked to be the Shankaracharya, but he declined it because he was not a high enough caste Brahmin.
Hmm. Deviation from Jyotish, but what do you think the importance of the caste system is? And what dharma, role does it play?
Dharma. To eliminate any confusion in life as to what I'm supposed to be when I grow up. It's as simple as that. It's not to keep anyone suppressed. It's exactly the opposite. The caste system is a system that is designed to lift everyone up and allow them to become as successful as they possibly can be. Via the DNA. So within the DNA, you can imagine what it's like if you were born into a family of pot makers making clay pots, you know, throwing clay, and you're the 30th, 35th, 40th generation of pot makers. What kind of skill you would have in your fingertips? What kind of creativity you would have in your mind? Because of those prior 39 generations of knowledge and experience behind you. Now, you apply that to something finer, mathematics, astronomy, astrology, health and healing, how subtle it can get, how very, very powerful it can become. So, no, the caste system is not what the British would have you believe the caste system is. The caste system is not what it has become. It's not a system for suppression. It's a system for liberation, a system for liberating one's potential and making it as maximum as it possibly can be. So within the context of, say, being a healer, if that's your dharma, if that's the caste system you were born into, the caste that you were born into, you're a Brahmin and you're a Vaidya family, a family of Ayurvedic doctors. There's no restriction in terms of how you can heal. There are eight different systems within Ayurveda, eight different branches within Ayurveda. You can become an expert in any one of those. Different families specialize. The Ashtavaidyas in Kerala study all eight. They don't take any chances with it. They just study all of it. So. It really is a very refined system for maximizing potential, is the way I think of it.
And
for those of us born without caste, you know, we basically have to stumble around and find our way.
Okay, great. Okay, beautiful. Well, Blaine, I think that's a good, great dynamic interview of various topics.
Thank you.
And I actually wanted to go into the 12 rising signs, the Lagnas.
Yeah, I was expecting that. You didn't ask.
No, so everything was just too good. I enjoyed it. And the later it got, it was just like, oh, if we go through this, it's going to be like an extra 2 hours. So.
12 signs, that's a big topic. So.
Yeah. So I think another time we'd love to do that.
And yeah, we can do that. Yeah, absolutely. We'll just email me and we'll set up another date and a time and we'll
beautiful.
Do that.
So for those, again, I highly recommend diving into Jyotish, diving into your own personal Jyotish. If people want to get in reading with you, Blaine, how do they do that?
I don't advertise. I don't have an internet presence. The tradition that I studied Jyotish with asks me to hide, to make myself difficult to find. And I love it because it means that there's a definite karmic connection between me and anyone who finds me. So I have a genealogy with every client I have. I know who sent them to me. I know where they came from originally, like that. And it's a really strong connection. So people can get in touch with me now. This is like an advertisement. It's kind of more like I acquiesce to it because I know who you are and the kind of people that are attracted to you. To get in touch with me, it's best to email me. And my email address is blainepw@gmail.com. So that's BLAINE, P for Peter, W for Watson, blainepw@gmail.com. And I usually respond within minutes. I'm very, very good with the communication side of the picture. Getting in touch with me by phone is impossible because I'm on the phone all the time. But if they email me, that would be fine. I just need their time. I send out a letter. You know what the letter is. You've seen it yourself. And I am booking now into the middle to the end of September.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Anything else you want to leave the audience with?
Relax, enjoy. The world is in good hands. We're not falling apart. It's all just the process of evolution. And everyone's life is designed for maximum realization of potential. How you get there, how you enjoy that is up to you. But the idea is to understand that everything is well and wisely placed, and there's nothing really to worry about at all.
Thank you, Blaine.
Jai Gurudev. Jai Gurudev. And we'll talk to you again soon, huh?
Yep, I hope you're inspired to get into Jyotish and especially know your own personal Jyotish. So if you want to find an appropriate Jyotish to have a consultation with, you can go to the Friends of Vital Veda section in the About section of our website, About Friends of Vital Veda, and find all my friends, not only friends, but people I really recommend, and not just people. There you can find all, you know, essential services, essential products, meditation teachers, the best water filters, the best cookware, the best blue light blocking glasses, software to protect your eyes, so many things in the About section. And then the Friends of Vital Veda, including Jyotishis, where to buy the best gemstones for Vedic astrology. And of course, if you listened clearly, you have Blaine's email from this, and get on his wait list if you want to, especially if you do not know your birth time. If your mother or father or no one recorded your birth time, definitely hit Blaine up. It's a very good thing to have your exact birth time to the minute. And I hope you enjoy. If you appreciate this stuff, I would much appreciate you to take action, not just listen to this and say, yeah, they all say that. Actually take action, do something yourself to contribute. It will make you feel fantastic and ripple out and really help me. You know, this is a lot of work, but yeah, do that by sharing, reviewing, you know the drill. All right, until next time, we got some good stuff coming up. So just make sure you subscribe. Much love.